You're listening to What a Killer Podcast. I'm your host, Nancy. Thanks so much for listening in. I'm so grateful for you all for the listens, for the feedback. Please like, follow, share, all those great things. I will say my birthday is in a couple days from now. I have had this episode ready to record for about a week or so now. But my lovely husband gave me my new laptop for my birthday. So, it's been a learning curve, just trying to get into some of the new editing software and stuff that I'm using. I'm using a different platform and things now. So it's definitely different, really cool. There's a lot more options and things. So I'm hoping to get better at it. So bear with me. you also will probably hear my cat again because I am filming from inside my what we'll call pod lab, but it's my closet. He's in here with me because he's glued to me at all times. Actually at the end of this show, I'm going to play a recording from the killer, like their last interview, like from like the 90s or whatever. A long time ago, but in it, when I was recording it to add to the episode, my cat was very talkative. You're probably going to hear him crying a lot in it or talking. He's doing whatever you want to call it. But just a heads up that my cat Chase will make an appearance again. So let's jump right in. So from 1989 to the late 90s, police had the bodies of 7 middle-aged men in Central Florida to investigate. Well, there were 6 bodies. One man's body is still missing. It was never recovered, but he is confirmed to be dead and murdered by this killer. All men were robbed of their belongings, their vehicles, and left for dead with gunshot wounds. The first was Richard Mallory. He was a 51-year-old electronics repairman and shop owner in Clearwater. Standing just under 6 feet, some might say he was a handsome man, dark hair, hazel eyes. Now, he was divorced 5 times, so, you know, he couldn't have been that bad looking. he was a known alcoholic who did frequently go MIA on some drinking binges, where he would search out prostitutes. He was also known by his exes to be quite aggressive in bed. He did like more of the rougher kind of things. He was also a regular at local strip clubs. As I said, he was into like hardcore pornography, things like that. Overall, he didn't have a lot of friends, not many male friends. He did have some women around just because, you know, he would pay for them and all those things, but he was described as a secretive loner who would live a very paranoid life. He would change his locks in his apartment often. At one point, he even claimed he had an affair with an ambassador's wife, so he thought people were following him. So with that, he was actually going to get plastic surgery to change his face to make himself unrecognizable. So yeah, he had some paranoid stuff going on. He also had previously spent 10 years in a mental institution after facing a conviction for attempted rape. He was nearing bankruptcy at the time. His business was quite successful, but because of all his drinking, drugs, and just sex binges or whatever you want to call it, where he would spend all his money and money he obviously didn't have. So at the time of his death, he had actually owed about $4,000 in rent or so. All his credit cards were closed for non-payment. He would only accept cash payments at work because his business was also about to go bankrupt. So he was murdered November 30th, 1989, but he wasn't noticed missing until police officers found his abandoned car 2 days later. And then they're like, going around to find this guy and no one had seen him. There were lots of fingerprints in the car from the killer. Just a tidbit because this will come up a lot. December 13th, his body was found. His head down to his collarbone had actually been completely skeletonized. Because again, we're in Florida, so the weather, it's very hot, very humid. A lot of animals and insects and stuff were eating at his body. He was covered by a piece of cardboard, but his fingers were exposed, which is how the gentleman had found him. He just saw like fingers sticking out from underneath this cardboard. He was fully dressed in a hoodie and jeans, and immediately they noticed his pockets had been turned out, so robbery was clearly one of the biggest parts here. During autopsy, they discovered 4 shots to the torso, 2 of which had hit his left lung, causing his death. The next victim was 43-year-old Richard Spears, who was described as an honest, hardworking man who was someone everyone could count on. He was a divorced concrete construction worker in Winter Gardens near Orlando. He was tall, 6'4", with a beard and gray hair, and he was said to be a man that wouldn't even hurt a fly. He still cared for his ex-wife. He always gave her part of his paycheck still to help with her bills. He was said to be quiet and shy. May 18th was the last time he was seen, and he was declared missing on May 19th. The following day, on the 20th, his truck was found abandoned, and there was a long blonde hair on the steering wheel. So, again, evidence. There was also a discarded Trojan condom wrapper on the floor. Again, he had been robbed because anything of value in that truck at all was gone. Much like the other victims, everything was found at pawn shops throughout the investigation. He also had about $600 on him because he had a cash emergency fund in his truck. He was holding on to some money for his daughter's graduation and then some money from his paycheck. So all of that was gone as well. June 1st, a badly decomposing nude body of a man, or well, actually, sorry, not of a man, they didn't know at the time, was found. The only piece of clothing they were wearing was a camouflage baseball hat on his head. Now, near the body was that used condom from the wrapper they had found in the truck. Again, DNA. Also, well, DNA, ugh, probably wasn't that popular at this point, but fingerprints was. Keep that in mind. So there were also many empty beer cans around. You're going to notice this a lot. It's always Budweiser cans. So the killer clearly liked Budweiser. At the time, as I said, they didn't know if it was a male or female because the body was so badly decomposed. What's crazy is that the body was lying on its back, fully nude, and it was so decomposed they couldn't even tell, like, what kind of parts it had, if it was male or female. Isn't that wild? Even more crazy. So the autopsy concluded he was shot 6 times. This part is bananas. I mean, it's, I guess, common because with decomposition, but he was so badly decomposed that originally he weighed probably around like 195 pounds when he was alive. Now, when his body was discovered, because of all like the animal interactions and stuff with his body and just the heat and whatever, his remains weighed 40 pounds. That's it. So he went from 195 pounds to 40 pounds in that little of time. Crazy. I don't know. I thought that was wild. So 5 days later, another murdered victim. This is 41-year-old Charles. Oh boy, I'm gonna brutally do this name wrong. Carcadon. That's all I'm saying it that one time. I apologize. I looked up how to say it previously and it's gone. He was a former road digger and rodeo rider. He was last seen packing up his things and hitting the road to go to Tampa, Florida to pick up his girlfriend Peggy, who was going to come live with him in Missouri, where he was about to start a new job as a press operator. June 6th, his body was found covered in an electric blanket, wearing only a black t-shirt and a pair of gray snakeskin cowboy boots. He was shot 9 times in the chest, and his car was found the next day. Peter Simon, 65, he was a religious man who people said was a real gentleman. He was a retired merchant seaman from Jupiter, Florida. On June 7th, he packed up his car, a luggage bag, and a stack of Bibles, planning a trip to spread the word of the Lord while visiting his family in Arkansas and New York. His body was never recovered. This is the one that I told you they know was murdered, but they just didn't know where his body was. Now, the killer would later confess and say that his body is in the woods somewhere in Georgia. So that's kind of all we know about it. But his car was found on July 4th. This one was wild. So two men crashed it, were witnessed by a ton of people. People went over to assist the women. They yelled at them not to call the police. They were like, had blood and everything because they had just gotten in a car wreck. They were injured a bit. They tried to just get in the car quick and drive away. The car wouldn't back up in reverse. So they were stuck. So what did they do? They got out, ripped off the license plate, took the keys, threw them into the woods, and then they tried to abandon the car and take off and hitch a ride. People are just watching this like, what the fuck is happening? So the women were pretty drunk. They said the blonde one was very rude and angry. So instead of picking her up, a passerby called 911 because he's like, I ain't having her get in my fucking car. When emergency responders got to the scene, the woman denied that they were even in the car. Didn't even know about the car, didn't see the car before, that wasn't them in the car. So months later, though, when they check the evidence in that car, there were bloody prints everywhere. Their bloody prints, blood stains, because, you know, they were bleeding, so their blood was all inside the car everywhere. So at the time of the accident, though, police made sketches of the two women because, again, they took off to try and identify them, to no avail because, you know, they didn't run the fingerprints yet. We're still not at the point where they're like, let's take some prints and put them into the system. Maybe this killer is in the system. Eugene Burris, known to friends and family as Troy. He was 50 years old. He was a married sausage salesman from Ocala. He was 5'6", built with blue eyes and blonde hair. He was said to be a very talkative man, as, you know, any good salesman is. On July 30th, he set out for some business dealings and delivering products. When clients hadn't received their deliveries, people got pretty concerned. And when he failed to make any contact with anyone, by 2 a.m., his wife, Rose, called in a missing person. So 4 a.m., just 2 hours after he was reported missing, that delivery van was found abandoned. 5 days later, August 4th, a family was out for a picnic in a national park, found his decomposing body. He was shot 2 times, 1 in the chest and 1 in the back. Charles Humphreys, 56, lived in Crystal River. He formerly was a police chief in Alabama. And before he, listen to the contribution of this man, before he died, he was an investigator who specialized in protecting abused and injured children. Like, that's the person you've taken from this world. Good job. He had a wife named Shirley who had been battling cancer, and he had 3 children. He was a very punctual man, so when he didn't arrive home for dinner on September 11th, it immediately set off alarms. The next evening, his body was found, shot 7 times. He was missing his wallet, again, anything in his pockets, everything, just everything. On the 19th, his car was found, plates, keys, and his highway patrol bumper sticker, everything missing. Again, a beer can, Budweiser, found inside the car. No prints were checked or even dusted in this one. Just FYI. Lastly was Walter Antonio. He was a 60-year-old truck driver who was also a reserve police officer in Brevard County. November 11th, he was going for a drive to Alabama to find a new job since he was recently engaged and wanted to start a new life. On the 18th, a police officer off duty was out hunting and found his naked body, only wearing a pair of socks. He was shot 3 times in the torso and 1 in the head. His car was discovered November 24th in a wooded area, and Just like the rest, it was scavenged, everything taken, everything searched. Yeah. Clearly robbery motive. The police had a lot of leads, really, and a lot of evidence that they kind of ignored. The killer was anything but professional. Like, if you could be good at killing, this killer was not. They were sloppy and careless. They left everything behind. They had the exact same MO with every single killing. Like, there was no trying. It was just do it and that's it. No one cares. Like, yeah. The suspect even brazenly would go out driving these men's vehicles around for days sometimes before abandoning them because witnesses would see them driving around. There was also, of course, personal belongings taken. So anything of value, they would go to pawn shops, leaving IDs, witnesses, like just no trying to not be caught. It was then also people identified the women in the sketches from that car accident from the murdered man's car. They were identified, of course, as Eileen Warnos and Tyra Moore. So who are these women? Eileen Carol Pittman was born February 29th, 1956 in Rochester, Michigan, to her birth mother, Diane Warnos, who was 14 when she married 18-year-old Leo Pittman. In 1955, the year before Eileen was born, Diane had already given birth to a boy named Keith. And a month later, she was pregnant with Eileen. 2 months before Eileen's birthday, her mother and Leo got a divorce, and he was never in her life again. He left and was gone, which, let me tell you, a blessing. As shitty as everything is for Eileen, it would have been somehow even worse had he stayed around. So they don't remember him at all, what he looked like, anything at all about him. Obviously, I mean, Eileen wasn't even born at the time, but Keith didn't either. He never had anything to do with them. Leo Pittman, though, was a disgusting, vile, trash human. So zero loss on that one. He was later arrested for kidnapping and raping a 7-year-old girl. That's right, 7. And there's a lot of strong evidence suggesting that he murdered another young girl at one point before he was arrested. So that's who Leo was, because in 1971, that pedophile made a noose in his cell out of bedsheets and hung himself, which honestly, thank you. Thank God, because that's one more piece of shit out of the world. Diane was struggling as a single mom with 2 young children that she couldn't support financially. So one day when the kids were very little, around 4, she dropped them off at her parents' house, and later she called her parents crying, telling them she wasn't going to return for the kids, that they had to take care of them now. Eileen would later say, and I quote, "We never knew the damned whore. We never saw her again except for funerals. I spit on her. She can go to hell." Which, you know, I get it. Like, you'd feel abandoned at some point, but Eileen's grandparents officially adopted them in March of 1960. Larry worked in a Ford factory, and his wife Eileen was a stay-at-home mom. She had 3 kids of her own, one, of course, which was Diane. The other was Lori and Barry. Keith and Eileen were raised as if their grandparents were actually their parents, and they didn't even know any different until Eileen was around 11 when she found out that her parents were actually her grandparents. So also, that would be a really hard thing to take when you're just hitting your adolescence. So neighbors would later say the family kept pretty much to themselves. They're pretty quiet. At the age of 6, Eileen had already started becoming a handful. She was getting into trouble and kind of testing her boundaries. She would claim to be heavily abused by her grandfather, saying he would beat, whip her, and sexually abuse her. Later at trial, Barry, her brother, who's technically her uncle, would later disagree with those claims. She always made those abuse claims, And a lot of her friends also thought she was abused because she would like confide in them, and she was said to have lots of bruises and things. No one was a witness. I can't say for certain it happened or not. Again, bruises, kids. I mean, I don't know. I'm clumsy. I bruise easy. Now, spoiler, she is dead. So before her death, though, she did, however, say in an interview that she came from a decent family. So almost taking back some of the things she had said about them. So again, it's hard to kind of really know without knowing, right? Without the proof. There were also claims at an early age that she was sleeping with her brother Keith. Again, not confirmed by real facts, but kids in the neighborhood spread the rumors. It's weird. She was known at school as Cigarette Pig, which is like so sad. It's because she would do things to the schoolboys for cigarettes. She really wasn't liked in school. She didn't have a lot of friends. One person even recalled an incident where Eileen was pushed out of a moving van in front of the school, falling hard on her head, and no one went over to check on her to give her aid or see if she was okay. Nothing. They just kind of looked, laughed, and went on about their day. So she was really alone, you know, like it's sad. She had a sad life. She sounds lonely, like she's always trying to fit in and be a part of something. And then, you know, she hits adolescence and she finds out that even her parents abandoned her. Because, like, again, she had no idea that she was adopted. And, you know, meanwhile, she's an outcast with her peers. And now on top of that, she finds out even her own parents didn't want her. You know, like, I can just imagine the emotional roller coaster she was on. And if she had real friendships and guidance and support, maybe some counseling, something to help her along that, things could have been so much different. We don't know, right? It's a hard one. I mean, she did have some friends, don't get me wrong. She had a couple of friends that really stuck by her. One was this woman named Dawn. I mean, they were friends up until the end. So yeah. It's not a good story all around from beginning to end, unfortunately, because by the age of 12, she said she was a very heavy drinker, recalling this part is extra fucked. Sometimes she would black out at parties, and the next day she would have semen all over her clothes. You heard it right. At fucking 12. So there were people who even witnessed this. So the schoolboys were basically raping her and passing her around when she was drunk. Like, some of them were called at parties, watching her get blackout drunk and like pass out on a couch or something. And then the boys would just carry her off one at a time. Like, so fucking disturbing. Like, all around. These boys are fucked. Like, I wonder how they fucking grew up and how they could live with themselves. And all the partygoers. Like, where did she fucking... What kind of school was this? These kids were all shit. All of these kids were crap. Like, what an awful bunch of people to have around you. So in ninth grade, Eileen and her friend accidentally set off a chemical explosion, causing severe burns and scars to her face. By this time, she was thrown out of her house frequently. She would go live in the woods near her home. Guys, this is another bad part. At the age of 14, local kids in the neighborhood would hang out at this old pervert's house. He would have kids over drinking all the time. He would play music and have the girls like dancing and stuff so he could watch them like a fucking creep. He would even get the teenage girls sitting on his lap and give them money. Remember, she's like 14 at this point. And this guy was apparently friends with her grandfather and in like his 50s or 60s. So just keep that in mind. One night it said Eileen got drunk and passed out, so he kicked all the kids out of the house. Eileen was the only one that remained. She later would be pregnant, and she told her friends that it was because he raped her. a lot of them didn't believe it. They were like, oh, you wanted it. You probably went over and whatever. You were with the old perverted man. Guess what? She was a fucking minor, you little idiots. She cannot consent when she herself is essentially a fucking infant. Like, I hate that. You can't consent to something when you have no brain yet. You're a child still. You're growing. Like, your frontal lobe is not even developed. The age of 14, you know nothing about life. Yourself, barely. You know, like, it fucking pisses me off so much. I hate all the kids that surrounded her. Such little shitheads. So, regardless, it was never confirmed. There were also rumors, of course, that it was her brother's kid. Like, no one knows. No one ever knows. She was sent off to school for pregnant girls at that time, like pregnant teen girls. She had the baby, gave him up for adoption. January 1971, she gave birth to the baby boy. He was never identified. No one ever knows what happened to him. I really hope he went on to have a loving, nurturing life with real loving parents, friends, family, you know, what you hope everyone gets, right? So that same year in July, her grandmother died. After that, her grandfather tried to electrocute himself in a flooded basement. And years later, he successfully was found dead in a running car in the garage. So when both parents were dead, Diane, their birth mother, invited Keith and Eileen to move in with her in Texas. They declined. Eileen instead dropped out of school, began her life hitchhiking and prostituting. She would go on to live her life with numerous aliases. Like, I'm not even going to get into them. There's so many. She started racking up lots of charges for driving infractions, gun violations, skipping court. This part, hold on, I just have to get a little more comfortable here. This part may surprise you a little, but in 1976, at the age of 20, Eileen actually married 69-year-old multimillionaire Louis Fell. So she fucking went and married a millionaire. He'd met Eileen when she was just hitchhiking, and before long he bought her a big expensive engagement ring, and she said yes, and they were married. Louis was the president of a yacht club, so, you know, fancy fancy. This could have been quite the life and future for Eileen, a woman who grew up struggling. She could have had it all. So imagine how different things could have been for her. Her living this luxurious life and leisure and, you know, if only maybe she was a bit older or something. Because the problem was she was 20. She wanted to party. She wanted to enjoy life. She had lots of mental things going on and childhood trauma that she wasn't getting addressed, like a lot of unhealed things. So she wasn't about spending time at home watching TV with her 69-year-old fiancé. Ma'am, find yourself a hobby and live the wealthy life. Instead, you go and live behind bars. You could have been in a mansion. So unfortunately, the story doesn't end here, but it would have been so nice if it did. On July 13th, she decided she couldn't sit at home anymore with Louis watching TV. So she dressed up in a miniskirt, boots, took off to a bar, got drunk, rowdy, as she normally does. Later, she was arrested for assault. 3 days later, her brother Keith would die from throat cancer at just the age of 21. Diane, of course, showed up at the funeral. She was acting very distraught and couldn't even sit through service. So people were quite annoyed since, you know, she hadn't seen him since he was a toddler. As time passed, Eileen spent more nights out. Her and Louis drifted apart. They stopped really speaking, only arguing. Then one night they got in an argument and Louis ended up with a black eye, courtesy of his loving wife, Eileen. The next day, Louis was determined that he was going to rein in this partying, aggressive wife of his. So he was going to threaten her with cutting off her allowance. You don't settle down, you know, and start being with me and spending time with me, whatever. Whatever he was going to say. Before he got to say a word, she beat the shit out of him with his cane, took a meat skewer to his throat and threatened to kill him. So Lewis ran off and immediately got a restraining order against her, and his darling wife was gone. A couple months later, they were divorced. Eileen was back to her life on the road. She pawned her engagement ring. She had a $10,000 life insurance policy from her brother's death. She bought a black Pontiac, which later would literally, like a couple months later, it was repossessed. She bought a bunch of useless items. Like, she went to an antique store and bought a bunch of random antiques and a large sound system for your house. But guess what? She was living in her car. She didn't have a place to put it. Oh, God, Eileen. So she blew through her money within 3 months. She did what she knew to do now. Leave town, prostitute to survive. That was her life. In 1981, she lived with a man in a mobile home. He said she was quick-tempered, but also very warm and loving and resourceful. She said she loved the man, but after a fight, she felt he was just like all the other men. So she bought a 6-pack of beer, a gun at a pawn shop, drove around contemplating suicide. She would recall at that point in her life, she said, I quote, I had no car, no money, no family. I had nothing. I even tried joining the Navy, Army, or Air Service, but you needed a 42 on the test to enter, and I always got exactly 5 points off. So I was going to kill myself. She then stopped into a convenience store where she put her purse on the counter, like to get things or whatever. The attendant saw the gun that was inside the purse, assumed she was being held up. So Eileen was like, fuck it, sure, whatever, I'll take that whole $33 from the register. Well, this got her a jail stint, and this one's more serious this time than a driving infraction. She would spend a year in prison. During this time, she was said to be in numerous fights. She was released June of 1983. She went to live with a prison pen pal, and quickly that soured. So she left for Daytona Beach, where she started to stay with a truck driver. He too said she was very quick-tempered, but she was a pretty girl who cooked and cleaned for him. So to him, it was an ideal situation. In May of 1984, she was caught forging checks at a bank. In November 1985, she was suspected of stealing a gun and ammunition from another man who was providing her with a couple nights of lodging in exchange for sex. After that, she had her first girlfriend. After always having such issues with men in her life, she met this girl named Tony. They decided to start a business together and try to really make a go at life. Now, Eileen claimed she was the one who had purchased all the supplies for the business, like the steam cleaners and all this big expensive equipment. Well, unfortunately, just a couple months into the relationship and opening the business together, Eileen came home one day to find an empty apartment. Tony was gone. And so was everything, even the steamers, the cleaning supplies. The only thing she said that was left was Tony left the phone bill. So, yeah, how nice. She then met 24-year-old Tyra Moore in a Daytona Beach gay bar. They both said it was love at first sight. Tyra was from Ohio, but living in Daytona, working as a laundromaid. She was living with her work friend Cammie and Cammie's husband. Everything was great in her living arrangements until Eileen came along. She essentially moved in, spending all her time there, and that didn't impress her friend. They also didn't believe about her steam cleaning business because she would just walk out the door every day with like a briefcase. They told Tyra she had to move out because they didn't want Eileen staying at their house and being around all the time. And one day Eileen came back with a black eye saying she had been raped. So curious about all this, Cammie went, took the briefcase. And to her surprise, there was no steam cleaner in the briefcase. Just a bunch of business, man's business cards and packs of condoms. So she confronted Tyra, who knew all along that Eileen was really a prostitute. She said she thought it was exciting, actually, and she liked it, which completely shocked Cammie, since Tyra had recently been baptized and had a growing relationship with the church. She had been doing Bible study, taking classes, and, Eileen and Tyra were in love, though. So, now homeless, Tyra asked a church friend if she could rent a room, and but there would be rules. Eileen would not be allowed to sleep in the same room with her and stuff. So Tyra was like, no. So yeah, they declined. So in 1987, they bought a trailer. No idea how. No one knows where this money came from. They parked it inside Ocean Village Camper Park Resort, which quickly they became the talk of the park because, you know, they'd hang around in the park in their underwear. Apparently around their trailer was just like junk and trash. A neighbor at the park said he liked Eileen, but she had death row eyes. Like she could kill you in a heartbeat. That's not probably a good thing you want someone to say to you. Not long into their stay at the camper, they were asked to leave because of their late night music and parties and all that stuff. At this point, she would even be cited for sending letters to a circuit court clerk. Like, who the fuck knows? What did this clerk really do to you, Eileen? Like, Jesus. She was known in Daytona to be a nasty woman. Public transit officers would receive a lot of complaints about her from the public. And even at one time, she had an altercation with a driver. She said she tried to charge him with assault. The driver testified at her court, actually, at her... Jesus. Whatever. I'm not going to keep stumbling on my words. So he would testify saying that she would start arguments on the bus for just absolutely no reason. One day, her and Tyra were boarding the bus, and he had mentioned that Tyra didn't look so good. Eileen took offense and punched him right in the mouth. So he pushed her out of the bus, and that was the whole assault charge. They would have more issues in rooms they'd rent, skipping rent, drinking a lot. She would later say Tyra was like her greatest lover, not as in like a sexual thing, but just an emotional one. Around now is when the murders began, which she claimed were self-defense because look how she slept with hundreds of men, she said, and didn't kill anyone. That's not a good argument, Eileen, because in just a year, you committed all 7 murders. So you're telling me you were prostituting for like, I don't know, 10 years or something, and everything was cool up until this one year you had a real bad year where you were assaulted so bad every time that you killed them? Come on. Now it is possible maybe Richard pissed her off or something. They were drinking and whatever. People said she would get really aggressive when she was drinking. I don't know. She left her, I think she just was so angry with men and just her life in general. She took her anger. She was just so angry that when she killed him and then, I mean, she got money, she got property out of it, lots of things. So then whenever she saw an opportunity, she didn't care. She didn't care about these guys. They meant nothing to her. Killing them was easy. It was easier for her to kill them than to walk away from them or to, I don't know, maybe even have sex with some of them or I don't know. She wasn't remorseful. She's never felt remorse. You can see it on her face all those years. She never once felt bad for what she did. So if anything, she maybe felt shitty about how her life ended up. But oh man, murder seemed to just become a solution for her anger, her resentment, her money issues. Like that was the solution. This is what I'm going to do. So after her first murder of Richard, which she would say happened because, like I said, he tried to rape her. No proof of that. We only have her story, so take with that what you will. After that, she went and told Tyra about the murder. They drove his car for a while, sold his things. Oh, not to mention some of his personal belongings. Tyra ended up wearing it and having it, like his jacket and his scarf. Oh, yeah. Tyra reported, sorry, just to clarify here, had Tyra reported this murder right here, Richard, because she was fully aware of it, instead, she was out walking around wearing these guys' clothes, all this stuff, wearing their watches, rings, like the rest of the men would be alive. But instead, she was also happy getting all this stuff, okay? Like, don't get it twisted. So keep that in mind. So Eileen now has killed many men. Their faces are sketched everywhere, and Tyra is getting real nervous because her face is all over TV. So Tyra goes back to Ohio for Thanksgiving. When she returned in November 23rd, Eileen gave her Walter's ring, you know, dead guy's ring. Tyra took it, all excited. Then with all the pressure and heat of the murders again, they just kept getting evicted from more places. Tyra was not happy. So in order to try and keep her to stay with her, Eileen threw the gun away, telling her, you know, this will stop, stay with me, whatever. But it was then that the woman put all their belongings into storage, with everything beginning to just be too much. Tyra gave the ring back to Eileen, and she took a Greyhound bus back to Ohio. She was very heartbroken that Tyra left her. She had stopped prostituting for a long time. She would spend her time just in motel rooms until she ran out of money, and then she was back on the streets at the age of 34. So it was becoming quite difficult to even make enough money for a night now. She said she had officially reached rock bottom. It was finally at this time, police had a positive identification on the two women they had been searching for. Some items that the victims had been pawned were identified and had been pawned by the two women. They'd given their IDs. They finally started running some fucking fingerprints. There was actually a fingerprint of Eileen on the receipt from the pawn shop. So, boom. Again, like, Eileen was in and out of jail so often. Her prints were in the system. So if they had to just run everything from the very beginning of Richard, again, the other six wouldn't have happened. So those prints also, like I said, of course, match the crime scene. Eileen was indeed with a new man now, Dixie Mills. He was an ex-Marine whose wife had left him months before. He said he found Eileen intelligent, yet wild and a savage party animal. He said there's only two people I've ever met who have met the devil and shaken his hand. One is me and the other is her. Then on Christmas Eve, he gave Eileen $50 and he went back to his wife. I don't know. It just seems like such a long process for them to find her, even though they had evidence. But, you know, things take time. But on Tuesday, January 8th, 1991, at 9:19 p.m., two undercover detectives posing as bikers spotted Eileen in a Port Orange pub in Harbor Oaks. Instead of arresting her, they began surveillance. They had random uniformed officers come and attempt to arrest her a couple times, but they were radioed off because they wanted to make this big surveillance where they followed her for a while and did all these things instead of just going and arresting her. They watched her pass out outside a bar on an old car seat. So again, just hanging out. The next day, they planned to keep her surveilling her, but then they found out that a bunch of bikers were coming through, so it would get real busy. So they're like, fuck it, we just got to do it. Let's just arrest her. Again, instead of just arresting her, the undercover approached her and was like, hey, you want to come to the motel and clean yourself up before this big party tonight? She was like, okay. She left the bar, and as she did, they arrested her first under a fake alias on gun charges just to kind of throw her off. This, of course, was, like I said, a tactic. I don't know. At this point, like, we already know she did it. They have a lot of evidence. Now, while in custody, they found Tyra. She was now living in Scranton, PA. So they flew there to meet her, get an interview. Along with her, she brought some of the men's things, as well as some items related to one of the missing persons who they had never identified as one of Eileen's victims. This guy's name was Curtis Reed, nicknamed Corky. The MO, very similar. His car was found, open wrapper inside, condom wrapper inside. The police never believed Eileen killed him, although some of his missing items and like clothes that he probably was wearing that night were identified by his family in the storage unit from Eileen and then some stuff that Tyra had. But they couldn't 100% say it was his item. So Eileen was never found to be the killer for Curtis. The weird thing is, though, like, she admits to killing all seven men. But for Curtis, she simply said, who? Who's that? So I don't know. I don't know why she would lie after admitting to all the other ones for so long. But again, man, it's Eileen. Who fucking knows? She's crazy. She is bonkers. Jesus. So initially, Tyra said she sort of knew about the murders, but she was so afraid of Eileen if she went and told. So she then returned to Florida. They put her up in a hotel room. She said she'd try to get some kind of confession out of Eileen. And then, of course, she would get nothing. So in order for her to get off, she had to help get Eileen's confession. Tyra was calling Eileen in jail, trying to get a confession. Eileen, of course, knew her calls were being recorded. So in the beginning, she was very guarded. But then Tyra kept saying, the police are trying to charge me, like I'm so scared. So eventually, she said, I'll do whatever I have to do. Like, you're innocent. I'm not going to let you go to jail. So over 3 days, they talked 11 times. By January 19th at 10 a.m., Eileen met with investigators and she confessed to everything in order to save Tyra from prosecution. The full confession took 3 hours. Once everything was made public, Eileen loved the attention and the fame that came with her being one of the first known female serial killers. On January 14th, 1992, she went on trial for Richard Mallory. Tyra testified she was not told of any altercation when Eileen told her of the murder. She said Eileen wasn't hurt and she never mentioned she had been raped or assaulted. Eileen did take the stand, and of course it did nothing to help her. She was, of course, convicted of first-degree murder. As the jury left the courtroom, Eileen yelled, I'm innocent. I was raped. I hope you all get raped. With her found guilty of capital murder, she was sentenced to death. When the judge read out the sentencing, he ended it with, and may God have mercy on your corpse, which shocked everyone in the courtroom. Everyone was just shocked that he said corpse instead of soul. I don't know, it was weird. So she didn't go to trial again. She simply just pled guilty to all the other murders. I like that, though. Like, just fucking, you're already in there. Don't need to go through more trials and all this stuff. Like, just fucking plead guilty. Like, you did it. It would come out over time that Tyra did, in fact, know a lot more than she ever admitted to, of course. I mean, she was wearing and carrying these men's items, knowing they were the items of the men, driving around in their cars, pawning all these items. Like, it's crazy. She was obviously a bigger participant than what we ever really have knowledge of. Eileen was 46 at the time for execution. She wore an orange shirt, blue pants. She is 5'4", weighing 133 pounds. Her cell on death row was 8 by 10 feet. It had dull pink walls and about 15 foot ceilings. She had black and white TV, a metal frame bed, a single chair, stainless steel toilet, a lime green cupboard for her clothes and personal items. It was quite dirty. And her view was of the parking lot of the prison. It cost $72.79 to keep Eileen in prison each day. This is what I'm saying. If the person's hopeless, like nothing, they're never going to get out. They're not contributing anything. I know a lot of people are anti the death row thing. I am in some cases. But if it's like I did it, I admit it, all the, like, a million, everything, there's just so much evidence. Like, just why? Like, why are you paying almost $100 a day? Actually, and this is back in the early 90s, so you know it's way over $100 today. Like, why you need to do it? Especially when they're, like, on death row. Like, she was on death row for how many years? And, like, there was nothing changed. So she had spent her time reading and writing mostly. On Sunday, September 29, 2002, she was showered, taken to a place for execution, shackles, and driven a long way to the waiting cell, which was a three-wall cell, dirty cream-color walls, 24-hour lighting, a toilet, sink, and a bunk. On October 9th, sipping a coffee because she refused a last meal. She knew lethal injection would be very painful, but she was ready. She was cooperative. She didn't resist the officers at all. She was strapped to the gurney with tears in her eyes, and she was wheeled inside the viewing room. The paramedics inserted two 16-gauge needles and catheters into her arms and connected them to the tubes for execution. They also attached a cardiac monitor to know when her heart stopped and pronounced her dead. They pull the curtains open for the gallery, and her last words, I'm telling you, man, she's a little bonkers. Her last words were, I'd just like to say I'm sailing with the rock. I'll be back like Independence Day with Jesus. June 6th, like the movie. Bog, mothership, and all. I'll be back. She was given the drug. She coughed twice as her lungs collapsed. Her heart raced, and then the second stage began where she couldn't breathe or move. Being paralyzed, still able to hear and see. Finally, the rest of the drugs were administered, which stopped the heart. She was then pronounced dead at 9:47 a.m. Her one true friend from childhood, as I said, Dawn, spread her ashes in Michigan in an unknown location. Some police detectives, and Tyra, on the other hand, they worked out a $2.5 million movie deal to sell their story. This was never confirmed. Money, none of that was ever really confirmed, if any of that actually happened, but there are, as you're aware, numerous Eileen movies out there. Tyra also wrote some books, things like that, but since has been living the quiet life. Her best friend Dawn stayed close to Eileen all throughout her death. She refused, she said, to forget the good time she had had with Eileen. And she knew her when they were growing up, right? So she didn't want to forget that part. So this is the case of Eileen Wuornos. She clearly did start saying some strange things near the end, but I mean, who the fuck isn't crazy when you're locked up all day, just with you and your mind? Like, I'm gonna play a quick clip just to end it off of her last interview with this guy Nick, who was doing a documentary on her, and it's the last interview right before her execution. And you're gonna hear some of the things she says, and you're gonna be like, wow, yeah, she was crazy, because she's talking about, like, you know, people spying on her and cameras in her cell and things like that, and people trying to kill her with food poisoning. Man, she don't sound that crazy. You be thinking that shit, like I said, if you are sitting in four walls all day long by yourself, just in your head, and, you know, people randomly looking in at you and these strange noises. Like, she ain't that crazy. She is crazy, obviously. She's bonkers. She's batshit crazy. But this kind of stuff, I'm like, I could see it, man. I could see feeling nuts like that when you're in that situation. It's a tough thing. Very tough.
I'm prepared. I'm all right with it. But like I said, remember, let them know that I know that the cops knew who I was after Richard Mallory died. I left prints everywhere, and they covered it up. And let me kill the rest of those guys to turn me into a serial killer. I know they did, because I was no professional serial killer or anything. I'm a murderer, or whatever you want to call it. You know,
what I was doing. I mean, how
did some sloppy work, you know? And I'm ready to go. Hey, I was tortured at BCI. They had the intercom on in the room, and they kept lying that it wasn't on. And they were using sonic pressure on my head since 1997.
Sonic pressure.
And every time I was trying to write something, I think they had some kind of eye in the cell, I'm not sure, but every time I started writing something, it went up higher. So I'm thinking that probably had the TV rigged. The TV or the mirror, something was rigged. They got a huge satellite on the compound. After they put the huge satellite on the compound, could have been either rigged to the TV set or the mirror or something. Because the electrician, when he put the mirror on the wall, he said, doesn't that look like a computer? The back of it, and they stuck it to the wall. It was crushing my head, and they were using sonic crusher continually. Then when I had 3 meetings with Miss Villacorta on it, every meeting I had, she increased the pressure of the volume of the comm, increased the harassment on the floor, increased the trays being inedible, just increased every bit of my complaints and trashed all grievances. They're trying to make it look like I was crazy at all times, rig up the room with torture. If I said anything about their whole, I think their whole plan was trying to make it look like I was totally crazy. And so nobody would believe anything I had to say about anything. And then drive me there if they could. I suffered so bad. I was really struggling to survive. Had a lot of trays that were attempted murder and everything. I had to wash all my food off. And then one day I didn't wash my food off and I was sick for 3 weeks, almost died. I'm okay. I'm okay. God is going to be there. Jesus Christ is going to be there. All the angels and everything. And, you know, whatever's on the beyond, I think it's going to be more like Star Trek beaming me up into a space vehicle, man. Then I move on, recolonize to another planet or whatever. But it's whatever's the beyond, I know it's going to be good because I didn't do anything as wrong as they said. I did the right thing. And I saved a lot of people's butts from getting hurt and raped and killed, too. Did you know that they were surveilling me before I killed? And then I knew it. And that it was covered up. Did you know there was helicopters dropping down from the sky, deputy sheriff, with decoys picking me up 4 or 5 months before my arrest? It was covered up. And I'm telling you because the cops let me keep killing them, Nick. Don't you get it? I was a hitchhiking hooker.
Right.
Running into trouble. I'd shoot the guy if I ran into trouble, physical trouble. The cops knew it. When the physical trouble came along, let her clean the streets. And then we'll pull her in. Out of retaliation for taking my life. Like this and getting rich off it all these years in total pathological lying. Yeah, thanks a lot. I lost my fucking life because of it. Couldn't even get a fair trial. Couldn't even get a fair investigation or nothing. Couldn't even have my appeals right. You sabotaged my ass, society, and the cops and the system. A raped woman got executed and was used for books and movies and shit. Ladder climbs, re-election, everything else. I got a big finger in all your faces. Thanks a lot. You're an inhumane bunch of fucking living bastards and bitches. And you're going to get your asses nuked in the end. And pretty soon it's coming. 2019, a rock's supposed to hit you anyhow. You're all going to get nuked. You don't take fucking human life like this and just sabotage and rip it apart like Jesus on the cross. And say thanks a lot for all the fucking money I made off of you. And not care about a human being and the truth being told. Now I know what Jesus was going through. They've been trying to tell the truth. And I keep getting it stepped on. Concerned about if I was raped. I'm not giving you book and movie info. I'm giving you info for investigations and stuff. And that's it. We're going to have to cut this interview. I'm leaving. I'm glad. Thanks a lot, society, for railroading my ass.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Please like, follow, share on all the things, on everything. What a Killer Podcast. Just search it on, you know, Instagram, Facebook, X, Patreon. I am, now that I have my laptop going, I'm going to start probably the speaker next because I want to start doing some news. You know, we have the Chad Daybell case trial starting. It's today. I don't know when this will be released, but court started today, so you know, got a lot of stuff to talk about. All right, hope you enjoyed it. Hope the audio was okay. Give me some feedback. I will tweak it a lot. Like I said, it's a process, and I'm not much of an editor, and it's just learning, right? It's gonna take time. So thanks so much, guys. Enjoy your week. Happy birthday to me. all right, thank you.